This is an emergency. This is an emergency. Please listen carefully. A corpse has been found in the green room. At the moment, it is unidentified, but we think that it is the body of a musician who worked with Australisis when it was based in Britain. No one in the audience is a suspect, but we believe there are suspicious circumstances. We have been told that the motives for the murder were almost certainly political. It seems that the pro-live music activists are gaining ground. They are violently opposed to the genetic manipulations, transplants, abortions, and acts of voluntary euthanasia which are regularly carried out on music at Australisis performances. Some factions are also suspicious of Australisis's non-Australian origins. We are hopeful of making a breakthrough in our inquiry very shortly. Although dead bodies do not usually make sounds, we suspect that this one will. We ask you not to panic and not to listen to rumours. However, we should warn you that there may have been some contamination of the pre-concert drinks. You will be wondering how you can help. Please look out for any unusual behaviour as you leave the auditorium and donate to the Australisis Lives campaign. But for the moment, sit back, forget everything, and listen. To return to that day, the event lasted seconds. Afterwards, there was an infinity of replays. Sometimes they would show the aeroplanes crashing into the towers, but there would be music in the background. It seemed to fit, as if the attack was strangely rhythmic. Or maybe the sound came first. Perhaps they orchestrated the attack to fit the pitch and tempo of the soundtrack. It was always Western music that was grafted on, and it was usually kitsch. It made people feel comfortable. Stockhausen allegedly said that 9/11 was the greatest work of art ever. Later, he claimed his remarks were misshapen by the media.
The soldiers forced him to adopt songs that were relevant of their nation, but not his. The Muslim man on crutches clutched at the contours of their alien tunes, while he silently heard inside his head the sweet salt spray of his homeland. The soldiers terrorized him into singing, but when they did not like it, they hit him with his crutches. Years later, he surrendered song, but clutched inside his ears the hillsides they had murdered, the Muslim man on crutches.
Fellow listeners, we all know that orchestras accompanied Jews and gypsies to the gas chambers. So today, we will debate the important issue, can music change anything?
Can it hold off banks?
Can music stop?
These will be cruel words, but I hope they will be welcome. Your father is not the person you call father. Your biological father was a pianist. He sent you the piano that you play on. Haven't you ever puzzled over why you love music and your father doesn't? You never asked me where the piano came from, which perplexed me. You have his CDs, but I will always wish you had heard your father in performance. He was famous, feted, but to himself he was a failure. As a performer, he couldn't change anything. He felt a slave to the score. He'd always longed to be a composer, and yet he'd never written a note. Frustration turned to desperation. Afterwards, I heard the worst. I know you have wished sometimes you had another father. Now you may wish it wasn't true. This is the tragedy of family. Again and again, I've wondered what he was listening to when it happened. I have often thought, perhaps he would still be alive if the music had been different.
Tell me, my dear audience, which way do you prefer me, live or at a distance? Of course, you may not have heard me in the flesh, in which case you do not have a choice. You must find it odd that I am speaking to you canned, when you know I am sitting amongst you. It's strange for me too. But it does mean that I have an alibi for this crime we've all found ourselves in the midst of. At least this part of me has. Over the years, my voice has been disarranged so much that I don't really know who I am or what I sound like. But I do enjoy being several people at once. It creates a welcome confusion and a comforting diffusion of responsibility. Most of my performances have been direct, but recently I've begun to play hard to get with my public persona. That's why I prefer not to appear in person tonight. I hope you will forgive me. It may be strange to have to tune into me at one remove, but then it's weird that most people only listen to the music of dead composers. There's an analogy here, I think, but like most analogies, it's rather shaky. A violinist tosses pictures through his fingers. A pianist strokes the keys with shaking hands. The lapping of the waves transfigures as a peal of laughter on his laptop. She wears sensors on her fingers, sensors on her toes. The gyrations of her hands and feet throw out a glittering trail of erratic clicks and hisses. Meanwhile, a fetus frenetically taps his foot to his mother's electronic heartbeat, and a wail of pain shatters into stuttering sound bites.
The woman with the transplant face does not like to look at her reflection. When she meets herself in the mirror, she finds her old face peering through, frowning disapprovingly. Is it even a little jealous? New chin? New lips? New tongue. They suggest a piecemeal language. Everyone's facade changes, but this woman's is foreign to her. It clings to the tense gaze of the suicide victim it has recently evicted. It is a mask she has reluctantly adopted, an intruder she must welcome in. But her voice, low and husky, sounds as it always has done.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is a great pleasure today to launch Music, Violence, and Death. This book features everything from the demise of classical music itself to a fascinating historical survey of violent events that have been accompanied by not-so-soothing soundtracks from Bach to John Lennon. The book answers every question about music and death you were afraid to ask. There are chapters about the sonic undertow of autopsies, but also the melodic backdrop for hangings and other forms of execution. All complete with accompanying CD and downloadable sound files on our website. This amazing volume also shows off music's undersold capacity for storytelling. There are tales of performers who have murdered critics, performers who have slaughtered each other, and players who have gone back more directly, axe in hand, to the source of the problem, the composer. There is computational analysis of serial killers who have shown polyrhythmic proclivities, and a rare transcript of a desert island disc show with Osama bin Laden. I'm glad to say that the book isn't just a deadly academic exercise either. There is a great deal of practical advice and information about iPods for coffins, sonifying your last will and testament, and psychics who sing to victims. So please, buy a copy, ladies and gentlemen, and enjoy before it is too late.
During apartheid, black musicians in South Africa were forced to engage in a sinister form of hide and seek. They were coerced into dressing up in white bars as waiters, but their main role was to play behind a screen while white musicians on the outside mimed to their music. When the police arrived, the black musicians would improvise again as waiters and revert to serving drinks.
Have you seen the documentary Music and Murder? Three men jailed for murder are rehabilitated through music therapy and the composition of songs. Their teacher tells of the joy of working with them and his optimism about their futures. But suddenly reality breaks through in real time. Daniel is the teacher's favourite, the most sophisticated musically, and the one who seems most transformed. But in the midst of the filming, temporarily out of prison, he murders again. How does this relate to our investigation? Does it mean we cannot hush our histories? Does it suggest that all of us are suspects?
I dreamt I was lying on a bed in a windowless room. Its walls were white and silent. Hours passed. They were colourless and empty. But slowly I became alert to the hidden sounds of my body. The rush of my blood, the swoosh of my kidneys, the click of my brain. At first I only sucked in the sounds, but then I made them respond to me. I bent this way and that, stroked my skin, rolled my eyes, drawing the music into my movements. I pulled and pushed for loudness and softness. I twisted the tempi in and out of position. I tapped on organs to exit or enter. This orchestra could play by itself, but I was in charge, the enthralled conductor. I immersed myself in jostling pulses, swaggering timbres, unorthodox tuning. The sound was so strong it bypassed my ears, so intense it suggested forgetting. Outside, sheets of music were flying away, flutes and cellos were hacked into pieces. In this room was a purely acoustic gestation. It squirmed and kicked until I woke up. Then, the performance aborted. They brought me a violin. I wondered where it came from, and I guessed its owner was already dead. The violin was an afterlife. It seemed to play almost on its own, It suggested a world of sound, though the dark brown wood was tacit. The guards commanded me to play. They said if I performed, it would save my life. What would it cost me to play? If I didn't comply, I'd be shot on the spot. It was certain death. But if I did, it would be a deeper passing from which I could never escape. I had to make a sign that they could not have the whole of me. They could not bend me to suit their contortions. And so I turned my back and put the violin under my chin. I played for them, but away from them. I drew out a long and slow lament, a piece that no one had realized before and no one would ever compose again. I played beyond the sound that rose up to a space that lay outside, a place beyond notation. The sound was pure. The music breathed out until it blew away. But I knew it would blow back, transposed and yet familiar. It would not be my final statement.